Director, International Center for Security Analysis.
That's a very famous triple negative phrase that effectively says that action without evidence is justified. It requires imagining what the worst might be and applying that imagination upon the worst evidence that currently exists.
Would Al-Qaeda buy weapons of mass destruction if it could?
Tony Blair.
Certainly. Does it have the financial resources? Probably. Would it use such weapons? Definitely.
Bill Durote.
But once you start imagining what could happen, then there's no limit. What if they had access to it? What if they could effectively deploy it? What if we weren't prepared? What it is a shift from the scientific what is evidence-based decision making to this speculative, imaginary, what if-based worst-case scenario.
And it was this principle that now began to shape government policy in the war on terror. In both America and Britain, individuals were detained in high-security prisons, not for any crimes they had committed, but because the politicians believed, or imagined, that they might commit an atrocity in the future, even though there was no evidence they intended to do this. The American Attorney General explained this shift to what he called the paradigm of prevention.
We had to make a shift in the way we thought about things. So being reactive, waiting for a crime to be committed, or waiting for there to be evidence of the commission of a crime, didn't seem to us to be an appropriate way to protect the American people.
Georgetown Law Professor David Cole.
Under the preventive paradigm, instead of holding people accountable for what you can prove that they have done in the past, you lock them up based on what you think or speculate they might do in the future. And how can a person who's locked up based on what you think they might do in the future disprove your speculation? It's impossible. And so what ends up happening is the government short-circuits all the processes that are designed to distinguish the innocent from the guilty because they simply don't fit this mode of locking people up for what they might do in the future.
The supporters of the precautionary principle argue that this loss of rights is the price that society has to pay when faced by the unique and terrifying threat of the Al-Qaeda network. But as this series has shown, the idea of a hidden, organized web of terror is largely a fantasy. And by embracing the precautionary principle, the politicians have become trapped in a vicious circle. They imagine the worst about an organization that doesn't even exist. But no one questions this, because the very basis of the precautionary principle is to imagine the worst without supporting evidence. And instead, those with the darkest imaginations become the most influential.
David Johnson, intelligence specialist, New York Times.
You'll hear about meetings where terrorist matters are discussed in the intelligence community, and always the person with the most dire assessment, the person with the who has the kind of strongest sense that something should be done, will frequently carry the day at meetings. We must believe the most dire estimate of what could happen here. The sense of disbelief has vanished.
So the person with the most vivid imagination becomes the most powerful.
In a sense, that's correct.
We knew that Al-Qaeda's tentacles were beginning to become far-reaching.
There will be an attack. It is when within the United Kingdom. I think the if is academic.
It is only a matter of time, and its potential is huge.
How will we ever know when it's over? How will we ever know when the threat is gone? In the mindset we are now in, once we declare it to be over, will be exactly the time that we believe that they will strike.
You know, it's the way we live today. We're living on a knife edge.
This story began over 30 years ago as the dream that politics could create a better world began to fall apart. Out of that collapse came two groups, the Islamists and the neoconservatives. Looking back, we can now see that these groups were the last political idealists who, in an age of growing disillusion, tried to reassert the inspirational power of political visions that would give meaning to people's lives. But both have failed in their attempts to transform the world. And instead, together, They have created today's strange fantasy of fear, which politicians have seized on. Because in an age when all the grand ideas have lost credibility, fear of a phantom enemy is all the politicians have left to maintain their power.
And we have seen Americans in uniform storming mountain strongholds and charging through sandstorms. We have fought the terrorists across the earth because the lives of our citizens are at stake. And America and the world are safer.
The stakes are high. We are a nation at war. A global war on terror against an enemy unlike we've ever known before.
Faced with that choice, I will defend America every time.
In a society that believes in nothing,
Bill DeRoti,
fear becomes the only agenda. Whilst the 20th century was dominated between a conflict between a free market right and a socialist left, even though both of those outlooks had their limitations and their problems, at least they believed in something. Whereas what we are seeing now is a society that believes in nothing. And a society that believes in nothing is particularly frightened by people who believe in anything. And therefore, we label those people as fundamentalists or fanatics, and they have much greater purchase in terms of the fear that they instill in society than they truly deserve. But that's a measure of how much we have become isolated and atomized, rather than of their inherent strength.
But the fear will not last. And just as the dreams that politicians once promised turned out to be illusions, so too will the nightmares. And then our politicians will have to face the fact that they have no visions, either good or bad, to offer us any longer.
Raindrops keep falling on my head, but that doesn't mean my eyes will soon be turning red. Crying's not for me.
You've been listening to a video documentary, The Power of Nightmares, The Rise of the Politics of Fear, produced and directed by Adam Curtis, adapted for radio. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville.
I have been hesitant to write about the election till now. I have been very willing to forward inspiring letters from others, but I just cannot muster much hope or even angst for that matter. Yes, I am angry, but it is an old anger. I haven't trusted presidential elections since Nixon won re-election. I found myself over the last week among black folks discussing the extent of what we call white gullibility. Because face it, gay marriage was the Willie Horton of 04. An interesting fact, although most of my homophobe black sisters and brothers voted against gay marriage, they voted overwhelmingly for Kerry. We queer black folks obviously have a lot of work to do, but give me a break. How screwed up does it have to get for white folks to stop allowing themselves to be so easily manipulated by fear? The reason why the race card, the gay card, the illegal alien card, and the terrorism card all work is fear. Fear and gullibility. And people of color do not make up 49% of the voters, so obviously we were not the only ones voting for Kerry. But who do you think makes up the vast majority of the 51% who voted for Bush? You may not like hearing it, but I'm frankly tired of living at freaking ground zero but have no vote in Congress because we're a majority black city. I am tired that one out of every three black men in America have had a run-in with police, but then are disproportionately joining the military to die in illegal wars. I am tired of black folks dying of preventable diseases, but we can buy prescription drugs on most urban street corners and open-air drug markets. And yes, we die and suffer right alongside with all the poor and working-class white folks, but then many of these same people turn around and vote for the jerks who got us in this mess in the first place. Yeah, we black folks can be manipulated, but we tend not to forget who the man is. We have no illusions about who is in power and why. It is one of the benefits of racism. We get to see behind the curtain all the time. Hell, our parents, grandparents, and a lot of our ancestors had to mop the floor, scrub the toilets, and serve meals in that area. Most of us were trained to ignore velvet gloves, because those gloves come off so easily when dealing with people like us. So what the hell has to happen for white people to resist being used so readily? I feel like we need freedom rides again, where we send in teams of people of color to help our white sisters and brothers throw off the chains of oppression. We need to help them build up a resistance to the propaganda, half-truths, and outright lies. We need mass healings, the cure of the myopia that allows these poor, downtrodden white folks to be used and abused. I'm thinking we need to hold fundraisers so these oppressed white Americans can spend a week or two in the wilds of Oakland, Washington, D.C., the Bronx, or West Philadelphia, where they could learn to live with others not like themselves and recover from a sense of isolation. Just like some of them sent money to my urban neighborhood in the 60s so I could spend time in the woods and gain a bit of perspective. And so I am numb. I'm tired, and I'm angry yet again. But in the end, it doesn't matter, because no matter how numb, tired, depressed, or even angry I get, it ain't over. That is another benefit of racism, because in my gut, I know that tomorrow another assault is coming. They're not going to stop, and so neither can we. Not all that profound, but you know what? It got my people through over 400 years of oppression. We appeared docile and planned in secret. We flashed hot and took to the streets. We planted gardens, raised children, put up tomatoes, and prayed for the future. But at the same time, we also sent money and support to the NAACP, Marcus Garvey, SCLC, the Black Panthers, SNCC, Dr. King, and Brother Malcolm. We cared for our own in the now, and we prepared for the fight ahead, because to do otherwise is not an option. This is Katrina Messenger. The struggle continues.
There are two buses leaving from the area to go to the counter-inaugural protests in Washington, D.C. on January 20th. Tickets for the Ithaca bus are $40 and are available at Autumn Leaves Used Books on the Ithaca Commons downtown. For further information on that bus, contact Ithaca_inauguration@yahoo.com. Ithaca_inauguration@yahoo.com. A bus from Rochester is being chartered by Peace Action and Education. The fare is $60 or $30 for students and the unemployed. For more information on that bus, telephone 585-624-3673, 585-624-3673. You can also see this announcement on rochester.indymedia.org. Our next speaker, Mike Clark, is now a pastor at St. John's Methodist Church in Watertown, Massachusetts. He spent a lifetime active in the civil rights and peace movements, and most recently in a court case that uncovered the truth of the assassination of Martin Luther King.
The reason I'm here is that 3.5 years ago, the family of Martin Luther King sued a man who they had come to believe was part of a conspiracy to assassinate Dr. King. They had become persuaded over the years that James Earl Ray had not killed King alone and unaided, that he was innocent of the crime, and that they believed they knew someone who was part of a conspiracy to kill him. In the fall of 1999, they brought a civil action, a wrongful death action, in Memphis, Tennessee. It was a 5-week trial, and I served as the media liaison for the family and for the plaintiffs in their case. There were 5 weeks of testimony and 70 witnesses, and at the end of the trial, the civil jury in Memphis found for the plaintiffs, saying that there was a conspiracy in the death of Martin Luther King involving the man who we had sued and others unnamed and unknown. And so in that moment, in that courtroom in Memphis, history's verdict that James Earl Ray had killed Martin Luther King alone and unaided was undone. First time that a jury had heard the evidence. A first time the jury had been asked to render a verdict. And so that's why I'm here tonight. I was asked by the family and the plaintiff's attorney to be part of that effort in Memphis, Tennessee. But the story begins 35 years ago. The night Martin Luther King was assassinated, I had come back from the college where I was attending. I lived at home. I went to college in my hometown. We had been at an anti-war meeting that night, and I came back to my parents' house at 7 o'clock, and they said that Martin Luther King had been shot an hour earlier in Memphis, Tennessee. And as a young white man in a small town in Pennsylvania, at the height of the Vietnam War, in the middle of the most turbulent year in the 20th century, I wept because he was that important to me. 31 years later, I was in a courtroom in Memphis, Tennessee, with his widow and his children, suing the person we believed responsible for his death. So the first thing I'd like to say tonight is that life is sometimes interesting. If you had said to me in 1968, in a small town in Pennsylvania, as a 19-year-old college student, that 31 years later, I'd be sitting with that man's family in a courtroom trying to find out the truth about how he died, I would have said you were crazy. So my first point is, and it's a good point for all of us, is that life is sometimes more interesting than we imagine it's going to be. That's my beginning for you. In 50 minutes' time, I've got to do a lot tonight. First is to say what the context was for Martin Luther King's death. The story begins in January of 1967. A magazine called Ramparts, which was sort of a combination of Mother Jones, The Progressive, The Nation, and various other things all thrown together. In its January 1967 issue, had an article called The Children of Vietnam. In the article were photographs, black and white and color, of the effect of napalm on children in Southeast Asia. It was the first time that people in the United States had seen what our bombing was doing to the children of Vietnam. Martin Luther King saw that article, saw those photographs, at a staff retreat of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, said, "We must stop now, whatever else we have been doing, and we must begin to work against this war. We cannot continue to be silent, regardless of support that may pull away, regardless of support that may no longer be there. We must now work against the war." On April 4th, 1967, 1 year to the day before he was shot, April 4th, 1967, at Riverside Church in New York City, before a crowd of 3,000 people, King declared his independence from the war and made the strongest statement yet against U.S. involvement there. For the next 12 months, exactly, he became the strongest, most articulate, and most powerful single voice against U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia, April 4th, 1967 to April 4th, 1968. He continued to do what he had been doing already then for 12 years, continued to lead activities around civil rights, black liberation, human rights, and in the fall of 1967 added a third piece to the program. He began to talk about organizing what he called a poor people's campaign, a poor people's march on Washington, that would take tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of poor people, white, black, brown, red, yellow, and you would not go for an afternoon, you would not go for a weekend, you would go and stay for as long as it took until America addressed the gap between the rich and the poor. By the fall of 1967, every speech he made, every action he led, was talking about war, racism, and poverty, a three-point program. In the spring of 1968, something began happening in Memphis, Tennessee, which drew his attention. The first ever strike of garbage collectors in the history of Memphis began 35 years ago tomorrow. 1,300 garbage collectors walked off the job. None of them unionized, 90% of them African American, and the precipitating factor was that in the weeks before, two of their co-workers, after months of warning their supervisors about the shoddy equipment they were working with, fell into a compactor and were ground up like garbage. Two black men with families. when the strikers went out 35 years ago tomorrow, their signs simply said, "I am a man." What didn't need to be said was, "I am not garbage." The strike began February 12, 1968. King was invited to Memphis to support the strike in the middle of March. He came and made a major speech, and they asked him to come back later in the month and lead a demonstration. The person who invited him, Reverend James Lawson, Methodist pastor in town, his church was the site for the strike committee. And in the 53rd day of the strike, April 3rd, Martin Luther King came back to Memphis again to lead another demonstration. He had been there the week before, and the demonstration broke up in violence, led, we were later to learn, by agents provocateurs and police agents. But at the time, we did not know that. What it seemed was that Martin Luther King could no longer hold together a nonviolent demonstration, and so he said, "I must come back and show myself and Memphis and the world that we can still maintain nonviolent discipline. If we're going to have the Poor People's Campaign in the summer, we've got to come back to Memphis in the spring." On April 3rd, he returned and made a speech that night that probably most of you are familiar with, in which he eerily predicted his own death, saying that that others would get to the promised land, but he wouldn't. And the following night at 6:01, one bullet rang out, and he was dead. For the 15 months prior to his death, his calls for an end to the war, his calls continuing for racial justice, and this new promise of disruptive presence in Washington of poor people of all races and colors and ethnicities was his major platform. Memphis was part of planning for that, and on April 4th, 1968, he was killed there. That's sort of the setting. I was 19 at the time. I was aware of all these things. I was like many of you. I was involved in college part-time and organizing full-time. And so we knew what was going on in the world. And the night he died was a bad night. Almost immediately, however, an official story began to be put into place. And so just a few minutes on that. For those of you, has anybody ever been to Memphis, to the National Civil Rights Museum, or to the Lorraine Motel where the assassination happened? Okay, good. All right. Let me just do some quick geography. Dr. King and his entourage were staying at the Lorraine Motel, which is right here. And across the street was a flop house and a bar called Jim's Grill. The official story was that on the second floor of that building, from the bathroom, from the bathtub, James L. Ray shot one bullet, alone and unaided, shot Martin Luther King at a distance about 200 feet, then fled the scene. As he fled, the official story was, he dropped a bundle at the scene of the crime, which included a rifle with his fingerprints on it, which included a radio with his fingerprints on it, one can of beer with his fingerprints on it, and 8 unused rifle shells. Dropped at the scene of the crime, the official story said, Ray then leaves Memphis, flees first to Atlanta, and then to Toronto, and then to London, and then to Lisbon, and then back to London. And on June 8, 1968, he is apprehended after what was at that point the largest single manhunt, in the history of the FBI, with the FBI, British intelligence, European police forces, Interpol, all looking for James Earl Ray. And on June 8, 1968, he was apprehended. Extradited back to the United States on March 10, 1969. On the advice of counsel, he pled guilty to the crime after having planned a defense for 9 months. 2 weeks before the trial, he changed his plea, entered a guilty plea, accepted a 99-year sentence. And as he was walking out of the courtroom, said to the bailiff, "I think I just made a mistake." He spent the next 29 years trying to get a new trial from behind bars. But the official story was that this guy, a poor white man from Missouri who had spent most of his adult life in prison, who hated blacks and hated Martin Luther King in particular, stood in a bathtub in the second floor room of a rooming house 200 feet away from the Lorraine Motel, fired one shot, and changed the history of the world. For 29 years, Ray tried to get a new trial. In the spring of 1998, he died of liver failure in prison. I had begun to be involved in trying to get him a new trial, working with his attorney, working with Jim Lawson, who had invited King to come to Memphis in the first place, who was also believed that Ray was innocent and was trying to get him a new trial. When Ray died, it appeared that the case was over. But by that time, a man named Lloyd Jowers had begun to be of interest to the King family and to those of us concerned with the case. He had been talking about having played a role in an assassination conspiracy. The state of Tennessee was not interested in prosecuting him. They did not offer him immunity so he could tell his story. And so the only thing left open to the family was to bring a wrongful death action against him, trying to hold him liable in civil court for the actions they'd been involved in Memphis. And so in November of 1999, that's exactly what we did in a civil courtroom in Memphis, Tennessee. I have to say that I was not there as an objective observer. I can present both sides of this story, and in the questions and answers, we can talk about those things. But I was there as part of the plaintiff's team, working with Coretta Scott King and three of her children, suing Lloyd Jowers. So I was sitting there with the family. I wasn't objectively in the news box or any of that business. I was part of their team. On the opening day of the trial, I wish you all could have been there, because we were selecting a jury, and in a civil courtroom, one could imagine that one might be, well, hearing a medical malpractice case or adjudicating a car accident, or maybe even a divorce. In a civil courtroom in Memphis, those were the possible things you might be experiencing. When the potential jurors came into the room, the judge said two things to them. He said, first of all, the summons that you've all responded to says that you'll be here no more than 5 days. And he said, I have bad news for you. You'll be here a lot more than 5 days. And people began to groan. And then he said, you're going to be asked to decide whether Martin Luther King died as a result of a conspiracy. And so I wish you could have seen the expressions on their faces, no matter what they decided, no matter what they heard, no matter what judgment they made, no matter where they came down on this 31 years after the fact, they were going to be part of history in a way that they could never have imagined. And you could see it in their faces. And 12 people were chosen and 2 alternates, and the trial got underway. In a civil trial, there's no jail time involved. You don't need guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The standard of proof is different. It is if the preponderance of evidence suggests something, then you must find the individual liable. It can be as little as 51-49, but if the preponderance of evidence is in favor of one side or the other, that's the side you must rule on. The case began in November of 1999 and ran 5 weeks. I'd like to ask you something. How many of you at the time knew that the family of Martin Luther King was suing someone who they believed was responsible for his death in a courtroom in Memphis, Tennessee? This was November of 1999. What? Okay. How many of you knew 5 weeks later that the verdict was that the plaintiffs were right and that a conspiracy resulted in King's death? How many of you were aware of that news? And how many of you heard any of the 5 weeks of testimony or evidence, any of the 70 witnesses that we put on the stand to prove the case? Okay. That's what we've been up against since the trial. There was a wonderful photo opportunity the first day. Coretta King, 3 of her children, walking down the hall of a courtroom. That was great. That was all over. There was a great photo opportunity the day of the verdict, and that was great. And in between, for 5 weeks, the 5 weeks in which we proved the case to the satisfaction of the jury, there was no coverage whatsoever. So tonight, just for a couple of minutes. I'd like to talk about some of the key pieces of evidence that were presented at the trial. You must realize it's 5 weeks, it's 70 witnesses, but I want to talk about a couple of categories of evidence that I think are very important. First of all, what we were alleging was that a man named Lloyd Jowers had been part of a conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King. Jowers had himself admitted that a man named Frank Liberto had given him $100,000 several weeks before the assassination, and also said on the day of the assassination, a gun will be given in your keeping, and when it's time for the shoot to happen, it'll happen from the backyard behind your bar, not from the second floor of the rooming house, but from a grassy area behind Jim's Grill, which is what Lloyd Jowers owned and where he worked. That, in essence, is what we were accusing him of doing, accepting money and handling the murder weapon, and the crime scene being the area behind the bar that he owned. So in three ways, we were suggesting the official story was wrong. First of all, the crime scene was not the second floor of the rooming house. It was the backyard. Secondly, the rifle was not the one dropped at the scene of the crime with James L. Ray's fingerprints on it. It was another murder weapon. And thirdly, it was not James L. Ray who had fired the shot, but someone else. Someone from whom Lloyd Jowers took the weapon after the shot was fired. That's what we were alleging. Two major categories of evidence. We had 10 areas of evidence that we presented. But one of the most important was that in the days, in the hours immediately preceding the assassination, support and security for Dr. King was being removed. Let me just point out a couple of those things. First of all, on his other trips to Memphis, earlier in that spring, earlier in his career, in other years, King had never stayed overnight at the Lorraine Motel. He had rented rooms at the Lorraine Motel, where during the day, community activists would meet together. It was a black-owned motel, and community folks felt more comfortable meeting there than going downtown to larger white-owned motels and hotels. But he never stayed overnight there. On the weekend before the assassination, on March 29th, the FBI sent a memo to friendly media sources around the country with this theme. Martin Luther King asked his supporters to boycott white businesses, but when he goes to Memphis, he always stays in fancy white hotels. When there's a perfectly good Negro-owned motel, the Hotel Lorraine. That was sent to hundreds of news sources around the country. It was printed in editorials the weekend before the assassination. It was mentioned in the United States Senate, where Martin Luther King stayed in Memphis, Tennessee, was beginning to be a major question, the question being forced by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And so on April 3rd, when he returned to Memphis, he stayed overnight at the Lorraine Motel for the first time in his life, nudged there, if you will, by forces beyond his control. Secondly, he was scheduled to be in room 202, which is right there on the first floor of the hotel, behind a kind of concrete abutment, providing, it would have seemed, more privacy and so forth. In retrospect, maybe providing more security. But on the day he arrived, there was a call that came to the owner of the motel saying that they needed Dr. King's room to be moved. It was an unidentified member of his staff, it was said, who was requesting a different room for him, room 306, which was on the balcony and exposed. And so Lorraine and Walter Bailey, owners of the motel, changed the room from 202 to 306, and the secure private room became the very public room on the balcony. Point three, on his earlier trips to Memphis, an informal group of bodyguards comprised of black detectives from the Memphis Police Department had been called into play. There were only 9 black detectives in the Memphis Police Department at that time. They considered it a great honor to be part of this group. They followed him around the city 24 hours a day and provided a kind of informal team of bodyguards. On the day before the assassination, Jerry Williams, The lieutenant who had done that previously was told by his supervisor, "There'll be no need for you to get the boys together this time. That we've made other arrangements." And so that team of bodyguards was not in place on April 4th, 1968. And Jerry Williams, now retired, testified about his lack of understanding still 31 years later about why that time, in contrast to other times, he wasn't being asked to pull that group of black detectives together. Point four, there had been, up until 24 hours before the assassination, five tactical units of the Memphis Police Department circling the block around the Lorraine Motel. They were there for surveillance and security, yes, but also would have been present, obviously, in the midst of what was later to be a crime scene. 24 hours before the assassination, those five units were all withdrawn to a five-block radius around the Lorraine Motel. Point five, the fire station across the street. All white firefighters except two African-American firefighters who on April 3rd, 1968, the day before the assassination, were told by their supervisor, "You know, there's no need for you guys to come in tomorrow. We have another assignment for you in other firehouses in other sections of Memphis." And they said, "Okay." And so on April 4th, 1968, when they would have been the only two black firefighters 100 feet from the crime scene, they were elsewhere in Memphis, in primarily white neighborhoods, in fire stations that were oversubscribed with personnel. How do we know that happened? Both of them testified at the trial. Never in their lives have they ever been anywhere but fire station number two, except for the day of the assassination, when they were ordered to report elsewhere for work that day. Both of them were alive, well, and told that story 31 years after the fact. Point six, across the street in the fire station, a black police officer named Ed Reddit, who was doing surveillance for the Memphis police, but who had been pulled off community relations just the week or two before to be put in the fire station to be watching the Lorraine Motel. At 4 o'clock on the afternoon of the assassination, his supervisor called him back to Memphis police headquarters and said, "Ed, there's been a death threat against you. We got to pull you out of the area. We're going to send you home where you can be safe and sound." He goes, "Wow, thank God." So he went home. The next day he went to the headquarters and they said, "You know, Ed, we might have reacted a little bit over much to that. The threat actually wasn't against you. It was against another black police officer, and he was technically in Knoxville, Tennessee. But Ed Reddit, watching the Lorraine Motel, 100 feet away from the crime scene, was withdrawn 2 hours before Dr. King was shot." We believed that if one of these things happened, it would be interesting. If two of them happened, it would be curious. If three happened, it would be perplexing. If all six happened, being directed to the motel for the first time, having the room changed, having the bodyguards withdrawn, having the tactical units withdrawn, having the black firefighters withdrawn, having the black lieutenant withdrawn, that we were looking at something that was more than curious or interesting or perplexing. We were looking at a pattern that was removing people from the area who might have provided either assistance or at least another set of eyes when things began to unfold. A second area of evidence that we presented was that at the same time that security was being stripped away, surveillance was actually increasing. So, point one, Lorraine Motel, as every hotel room that Martin Luther King stayed in during the last 9 years of his life, was bugged and wiretapped. And so all the conversations on the phone and among colleagues in staff meetings and informal conversations were being overheard. Secondly, within his own SLC staff, Southern Christian Leadership Conference staff, there was a paid informant of the FBI, a man named James Harrison, who came to Memphis with the rest of the SCLC staff and reported into the Memphis FBI before he came to the SCLC staff meeting. He'd been in the employ of the FBI for 4 years, was the treasurer of the group, was reporting everything going on inside the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And as they met at the Lorraine Motel, James Harrison was part of all those meetings. Point three, across the street once again on the fire station, there were two photographers on the roof of the fire station who were in place beginning on the morning of April 4th, who were photographing the Lorraine Motel and photographing what we came to believe was the scene of the crime, the area behind Jim's Grill. They were photographing that on behalf of military intelligence, who was their employer, and they were given access to the roof of the fire station that morning so they could maintain that photographic surveillance. How do we know they were there? They weren't testifying. They both live underground now in Central America. But the fire chief was there, who remembers that in his 40-year career with the Memphis Fire Department, there was only one time that he was ever asked to send military intelligence up on the roof of one of his fire stations, and that was the day Martin Luther King died. He was there testifying about it, not because he was a conspiracy buff, because he remembered something that had happened that was important and relevant to the case. So Harrison infiltrating inside, military intelligence photographing across the street, Memphis PD and the FBI wiretapping and monitoring the rooms. And then something else interesting. This is the most famous photograph at the crime scene. It has been reprinted millions of times in the last 35 years. It's been in every magazine, every newspaper, every book. Every year on the anniversary of the assassination, if there's any kind of photograph printed anywhere, it's always that photo. Sometimes it says friends of the slain civil rights leader. Sometimes it says staff members. But the caption is always the same. They're pointing across the street in the direction of both the grassy area and the back of the building with the bathroom. It doesn't clear that up. They're pointing across the street. But it says they're aides or friends or co-workers. And you can see Andrew Young there, who later went on to become a UN ambassador. Jackson is in the mix. Ralph Abernathy is there. All of King's aides are, in fact, there. But there where Dr. King lies, bleeding to death, is another man. There was a young black militant group in Memphis in the days of the strike known as the Invaders. They had been working out their disagreements with King and the SCLC, and their folks had actually been staying at the motel so they could sort of talk and try to work out any differences. The man there holding Martin Luther King's head as he lies dying is a member of the Invaders. His name is Morrell McCullough. And four of the Invaders testified at the trial. They're no longer young, but they're still committed to their community and still active in Memphis. And they said Morrell was our Minister of Transportation. And they were asked by the attorney questioning him, and why was he chosen? And they said, because he's the only one of us who owned a car. And so he'd pick us up at meetings and take us to meetings, and we made him the Minister of Transportation. He did that for us all the time. And Morrell, out of the goodness of his heart, when Dr. King came to Memphis on April 3rd, offered his services to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, saying that you tell me where you're going to be and when you need to be picked up, you tell me where you need to go and when you need to get there, and I'll take care of all that. He did take care of all that. He also reported in four times each day to the Memphis Police Red Squad because he was an agent of military intelligence on loan to the Memphis Police to infiltrate Martin Luther King's organization. How do we know that? His boss testified at the trial saying Morrell was the best agent we ever had. He could insinuate himself into any organization. I wish we'd had more like him. As Martin Luther King lies dying, in this picture you've all seen 100 times, the person holding his head isn't a friend or an aide or a staff member. The person holding his head is an agent of military intelligence working with the Memphis Police Red Squad. As security was being stripped away, surveillance was increasing. One other area of evidence that we presented at the trial was what happened to the crime scene in the hours after the assassination. Remember, the official story says James O'Rea is firing from the second floor of a building, from the bathroom, standing in the bathtub with the gun that he's bought. What we were saying was that the shot had been fired from the area behind Jim's grill, and that Martin Luther King had died as a result of a rifle shot from that area. We put on the stand at the trial a man named Leon Cohen, who had been a New York homicide detective for 25 years, who retired to Memphis. And he said on the morning after the assassination, he admitted that after 25 years as a homicide detective, crime scenes get in your blood. And he said, I couldn't help myself, and I went down to the crime scene, because I'd done that for 25 years, hundreds of times. When he got to the rooming house, there was no tape declaring this to be a crime scene. There was no tape asking for people to stay out. There were no police officers around guarding it or protecting it, providing it from not being contaminated. He said, I walked into the rooming house, walked up to the second floor, walked into the room that Ray had rented, walked into the bathroom from which he had fired the shot, and stood in the bathtub from which the bullet was allegedly fired. And nobody saw me. Nobody asked me anything. Nobody mentioned anything about the fact that I might be contaminating the crime scene, that valuable evidence might now be lost. Because if he could go up there and do that, logically, someone else might have been able to do the same. At the same time, in the area behind the bar, the area where we believe the shot was fired, at 7 o'clock the day after the assassination, the head of the Memphis Department of Public Works got a phone call from the Memphis Police Department, who said to him, get some men down there immediately and clear out the area behind Jim's grill. When the cops had arrived the night before, the brush and the bushes were so thick that they had a hard time getting from one side of the area to the other. And the head of the Department of Public Works got the order from the Memphis PD, go down there and clear that out. And on the morning after the assassination, essentially, that backyard was turned into a mini golf course. All the brush was gone. All the bushes were removed. All the stuff was taken away. What we believed to be the scene of the crime had now been tampered with in such a way that important evidence that might have been found there was no longer available. How do we know that that happened on the morning after the assassination? Because the head of the Memphis Department of Public Works testified at the trial in those pastel clothing that older men wear when they are golfing all the time in the South. He clearly had finished up one game, came to testify, was going to go back and hit the golf course again. He didn't even change out of the clothing. Not a leftist, not a conspiracy, not anyone who was paranoid. He was simply remembering that 31 years before he had done what he was told, and he was proud to tell people that they'd cleaned out that area pretty well. Indeed they had, and by doing so, contaminated the area that we believe the shot was fired from. Security was being withdrawn, surveillance was increasing, and the crime scene was tampered with. The last thing I want to mention about our part in the case was that our third or fourth witness was a man named John McFerrin. Now remember that Lloyd Jowers says that Frank Liberto gave him $100,000 and said a gun will change hands and you're the hands that will change it. And that was the basis for our accusation against him. John McFerrin was the first African American in his rural county in Tennessee to try to register to vote. He was the first African-American to try to organize other African-Americans to register to vote. He was the first person in his county to start a civil rights organization. And because of this, he ran a little grocery store. No white business in the county would deal with him. And so once a week, on Thursday nights, every week, he'd drive into Memphis, 40 miles, and pick up his produce for the week. On Thursday, April 4th, 1968, he came into Memphis. Was that the produce dealer that he dealt with, Frank Liberto, whom Lloyd Jowers said had given him $100,000 3 weeks before? He was standing there at Frank Liberto's placing his order for the week when the phone rang behind the counter. And because in 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee, African Americans were invisible, Frank Liberto felt safe in answering the phone as though John McFerrin were not there. And he shouted into the phone, "I told you to kill the son of a bitch. When he comes out on the balcony, you'll be getting your money later." That was at 5 o'clock on April 4th. Martin Luther King was shot at 6 o'clock on April 4th. John McFerrin stayed invisible, loaded up his stuff, and drove back to Somerville, Tennessee. When he got home, his neighbor said, "John, did you hear what happened in Memphis tonight? Dr. King was shot on the balcony of the Ray Motel." And McFerrin said, "I was just at the wrong place at the wrong time." But he called the head of the Tennessee Human Rights Commission, a white United Methodist minister, and told him the story. He said, "John, they will not believe you, but you need to tell that story to everybody in law enforcement, and I will go with you." And so the weekend of the assassination, the Memphis Police Department, the FBI, and other people already beginning to investigate the case heard that story from John McFerrin, that an hour before the assassination, he heard Frank Liberto say, "Kill the son of a bitch. When he comes out on the balcony, you'll get your money later." It was ruled to be irrelevant, and the story was not followed up on. John McFerrin waited 31 years to tell a jury that story. It hadn't changed. It hadn't wavered. What he heard that night, what he talked about that night, is what he said 31 years later in a courtroom in Memphis. And he was our third or fourth witness. At the end of all of this, friends, we thought, proved our case. We had talked about what Memphis and the United States and the world were like in 1968. We had talked about the garbage worker strike. We had talked about a conspiracy on the ground, literally, behind Jim's Grill. We'd indicated that Lloyd Jowers had himself admitted to a role in that. And we had shown, with 70 witnesses still alive, still telling the same stories they'd been telling for 31 years, but now for the first time to a jury. And so we rested our case with Dexter King, who was 7 at the time that his father was killed. The media spin about this trial, and I'm glad that most of you didn't hear the media spin. The media spin was that the family of Martin Luther King and those of us working with them were in this to make millions of dollars. That was why the family had sued Lloyd Jowers, to make many, many dollars. Or you had an alternative spin, if you didn't like that one, that this poor, benighted family had been tricked by a white lawyer into believing strange conspiracy theories. They could not possibly have come up with us on their own thinking, and they must have been tricked by an attorney, William Pepper, into believing all these strange things. Those are your two choices. We put Dexter King on the stand to talk about the night his father died, and we put him on the stand to talk about what it felt like being accused of bringing this case in order to make money, or what it felt like when people in a racist fashion said that black people couldn't imagine this on their own without the idea being planted in their heads by a white lawyer. There's a nice spin. And so at the end, in any civil trial, you ask for how much you think you're owed. And he said $100 will be fine for Mr. Jowers. And with that, we rested our case. The defense had a hard job. Lloyd Jowers had admitted 80% of what we were alleging. He was the first one to bring up much of these things. He'd said it to Dexter King and William Pepper in the presence of his attorney. He'd said it to Dexter King, William Pepper, and Ambassador Andrew Young. And we put a 4-hour tape into evidence of that conversation. So his attorney could only do two things. He said, first of all, Lloyd's just the owner of a greasy spoon. If he had any role in this, it must have been a really small role. We believed it was impossible to play a small role in the death of Martin Luther King. And the jury agreed. And then, creatively, he said he knew a gun was being fired from behind his bar, but he had no idea who was being shot. Well, you wouldn't have to be a rocket scientist in April of 1968 to know that 100 feet behind your bar, the most famous person in America was staying with the leadership of his organization. We didn't believe that story, and neither did the jury. And after 1 hour's deliberation, the jury returned a verdict that said Lloyd Jowers was liable in the death of Martin Luther King, along with other unnamed individuals. The day the verdict came in, there were press conferences held by the King family in which they really said that they believed that after 31 years, they felt that the truth was known, that the first time a jury had heard the evidence, they had ruled in this fashion, and that in fact it was an historic trial. But I can say, since I was involved with the planning of the trial, that we thought simply having the trial was historic. It almost didn't matter what the verdict was, because we were finally putting before a jury the testimony of all these witnesses still alive, still lucid, still wanting to tell the truth about what happened to Martin Luther King. But the verdict came through, and the jury, whether they knew it or not, helped to remake history. But in the little over 3 years since the trial, as evidenced tonight, and you're not even the average cross-section of the American people, let's face it, friends. Almost no one knows it happened. Almost no one knows what the verdict was. Almost no one knows any of this evidence. And worse yet, almost no one has considered what the implications are for our national life. If a lonely, bitter white man who'd spent most of his adult life in prison killed Martin Luther King because he hated black people, then America is one thing. If, on the other hand, a conspiracy resulted in the death of Martin Luther King, a conspiracy that government at the local, state, and federal level was involved with, took 31 years to try to prevent the truth from coming out, and still to this day denies that anything that I've talked about is of any relevance to any of you, then America is something else. If the last 35 years have proved nothing, it is that with the death of Martin Luther King, and 2 months later, the death of Robert Kennedy, in 1968, in the most turbulent year of the 20th century, it has had continuing consequences for 35 years of life. And so we believed at the trial that we were not simply trying to solve a murder case. It wasn't just a mystery. We believed at the trial that we weren't simply trying to get right an important event in the history of our country. We also believed that what we were doing was raising significant questions for all of us still to this day, whether we were alive when this happened, whether we were young when this happened, whether we were old and can now scarcely remember it. If what I've said is true, and took 31 years to get the truth before the people, then it has consequences for everything else that we do. In the midst of all that we need to be thinking about and acting on in these days, I appreciate your taking time to talk about a 35-year-old murder in the midst of all these other things pulling on our attention and our energy and our commitment and our heart. But I really believe that what I've said tonight has something to do with all those other things as well.
Pastor Mike Clark, speaking in 2003 in Western Massachusetts. Thanks to Western Mass Indie Media for that tape. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Contact us on email at unwelcome@radioforall.net. Thank you for listening.
To help these poor